Right. Thank you for showing up. Good morning, and thanks, Matt, for invitation. It's always a pleasure to be here. I think last time I came here was 2 years ago for a large scale structure conference that was organized here. Nice to be back. 2 years ago, I guess this new building wasn't built yet, and this was still a bistro. So nice to see that, this was completed. It's a beautiful building. All right, so I'd like to tell you about the very recent work that we have been doing and which has been completed. And this is the first talk I will give on this particular subject, which is new probes of initial state of quantum fluctuations. This work is based upon three papers. So I'm going to talk about three topics, and it's been work done with my student, Jonathan Gans, in University of Texas. So the first paper and third paper deal with very different things, but this is where the motivation came from, essentially. So first talk about what the three-point function is, and then, so that will be the topic, three-point function is, and why that's interesting. Then I start talking about modifying initial vacuum state away from usual preferred Bunch-Davis vacuum, and then move on to this topic, which is to say, okay, these are the new things you can use to probe such modified initial states. All right, so the question really boils down to this. Do we now think that the inflation has happened, or are we not yet convinced? You know, does plot is good enough to you to believe inflation happened? Answer is yes or no, depending upon who you talk to. But if you didn't assume, for example, scary invariant spectrum, which is a prediction of inflation, you get completely wrong answer. And you won't see these nice peaks also if you didn't have this particular initial condition set up by inflation, namely super horizon fluctuations and so forth. Okay, if the answer is yes, I guess we can just forget about the second question, but we can still have to ask, okay, even if inflation did happen, what kind of initial conditions led to inflation? So that would be the second question I'll be asking. But this really is the motivation that I've been intrigued by over the last decade or so. Now, if that plot didn't prove inflation, second question one can ask is, okay, can we falsify inflation? Because the inflation is such a mighty thing. It can give you anything. Then it's not falsifiable. So then we're in the troubled situation. I'd like to clarify first what I mean by falsifying inflation. So first of all, I'm not really talking about alternatives which don't solve flatness or horizon problem. In fact, I think you still need something like inflation, accelerated expansion to explain the flatness problem. Maybe you have something like normal inflation, bubbles nucleated out of false vacuum, it's automatically homogeneous. So homogeneity problem can be explained by that, but you still need to explain flatness. However, completely separate question, although inflation solves it simultaneously, is this question, where do the observed fluctuations come from? You, on one hand, solve a flatness problem, but on the other hand, you create these fluctuations that we see today. Of course, one of the big successes of inflation is to give you a mechanism to produce such fluctuations that we observe today by quantum fluctuations. But you know, maybe this is something we can use to at least rule out inflation as a mechanism for generating the observed fluctuations. So that really boils down to that question. But doing this is not very easy. Therefore, first, let me start with, can we falsify single field inflation at least? And I'm not going to be talking about multi-field inflation today, so there will be no second question today. But we wrote a paper on this also, so if you're interested, please look at this. Sugiyama et al. Last year. So the easy one is adiabatic fluctuation. So inflation says, okay, single field inflation. Okay, what do I mean by single field inflation? By single field inflation, I mean the same scalar field is responsible for inflation and for generating the observed fluctuations. When you have two fields, say, one field is responsible for inflation dynamics, and second field is responsible for fluctuations, then I'm not calling that single field. So it's like a single source inflation. Everything is coming from single field. Then, since matter and radiation came from the same source, you need to satisfy this adiabatic condition, namely delta rho over rho for all the components is the same, up to equation of state. For example, you have, so this is a photon over density, this is dark matter over density, you have 3/4 just because rho dark matter goes like rho gamma to a 3/4. But aside from that, you need to satisfy this condition, which is something you can test. So if you detect violation of this equation, you rule out all single field models. That's a very nice way of ruling out single field, very well defined. Of course, so I looked for it and didn't find anything. So the difference between, so this is basically a violation of the adiabatic condition. In this fractional quantity, we find that, okay, violation is not seen. Limit that we're putting on it is 9%, which is not totally stringent. Planck, the new satellite, will improve this by a factor of several, but something to keep our eyes on.
Single field. Is that right? I mean, look, let's say I have an axion model where the fluctuations of dark matter.
Yeah, but now you have a second field, right?
Yeah, well, it's a dark matter.
But nevertheless, so that's
I
not.
Could have
but
field inflation plus an axion, which is the dark matter.
So important. Okay. So let me repeat my definition of what I mean by single field. Same scalar field is responsible for inflation and for the observed fluctuations. Yeah. So axion thing, in fact, this is for specifically axion constraint, is not single field in my terminology. Yeah. So this is important, by the way. So by my single field, I really mean one field for everything, including fluctuations. Matter radiation came from a single source. And that's still an important class of models that's worth testing. All right, then single field inflation, you can test in various ways. For example, you have the curvature perturbation, so-called scalar perturbations. Power spectrum goes like k to the 4 minus ns. Actually, no. Ns minus 4. There's a minus sign here. Then inflation generically predicts that the ns is somewhere close to 1. Okay, it is close to 1. And some inflation models predict that NS is actually different from 1, slightly less than 1. Well, okay, we see that. So if you talk to people like Slava Mukhanov, he will say, I predicted this many years ago, and that's a proof of inflation. That's fine. Okay, now you might look at other things, such as tensor perturbation, which is gravitational waves. For some, detection of this with a predicted scalar invariant spectrum is a proof of inflation. Okay, that's fine too. We don't see that though, yet. Then this is the upper limit, and because of this upper limit, this is the y-axis, the tensor scalar ratio. Some of the single field inflation models are gone, so lambda pi to the fourth is gone. Maybe m squared phi squared is in tension. This error will keep coming down. Planck, if it's lucky, may see r of about 0.1 in the future, in near future. So all the eyes are on this diagram. And but at, as far as the data concerned, as far as the current data are concerned, single field looks good. Then what about three-point function? So if everything looks fine, two-point function level, why don't we look at a three-point function? So three-point function, we have three k vectors which should form the triangle. And this zeta is the curvature perturbation that I'm going to define in the next slide. You have three of these, amplitude times this triangular condition, delta function, and you have some model-dependent function here. Now, because we have three momenta, you can talk about many, many different triangles. And first of all, this is the most important one. This is called squeeze triangle, where one of the wave numbers is much smaller than the other two. This is important because this is the thing that you can use to rule out single field inflation models. So I'm not going to talk much about all the other configurations. Just stick to this. Curvature perturbation is this. So you have a metric, and you and write this down in terms of a usual form, lapse function. You set shift to be zero on larger scales, so forth. And then you say, OK, now I'm going to pick a gauge in which the energy density of the universe is uniform. So energy density is unperturbed. Then you define this zeta to be a curvature perturbation, which happens to be conserved outside the horizon for single field inflation. And then this lapse function can be found from the Hamiltonian constraint. So it's really, there's only one dynamical degree of freedom, which is zeta. Then for the entire talk, I'm always simply talking about this simple, vanilla, single field, canonical scalar field with Einstein gravity. The only thing I'll be talking about is the modification of initial state. Then Maldacena worked out this nice formalism where now I can calculate my three-point function, which is simply given by the commutator of this zeta cubed with the interaction Hamiltonian, which is simply given by the action, which is nothing but this with that expanded to the cubic order. That's that. He worked out. You simply plug this in here, do the calculation, and then you end up having the answer. But before you proceed, you have to know what the modal function of this zeta is, which you can do in the usual way. You decompose this into annihilation and creation operator with the modal function. And then particular choice of initial vacuum state, which will be the topic of this talk, amounts to choosing what form of modal function. Now let me first stick to the usual choice, which is to say, okay, you have a Dositter invariant vacuum state, only positive frequency mode, therefore there will be no particles seen by commoving observer in Dositter space. That's that. If you have particles, you have an extra term, which is proportional to e to the plus ik eta, where eta is conformal time, which is the subject of the following part of my talk. But let me first stick to this thing, standard choice. And then you have the result, which is obtained by Maldacena, which is complicated. You have complicated momentum dependence. But then let me take a limit where K3 is much less than K1 or K2. Then this becomes K1 cubed, this becomes K1 cubed, this becomes K1 cubed, this becomes K1 cubed. For the rest of my talk, I will be assuming that the K3 is always the smallest real number. K1, K2 are the largest, and they are equal. Then you have this magical result. Boom. So you get just this times the quantities, which are small, smaller parameters. Then you have 1 over K1 cubed and 1 over K3 cubed, which is nothing but, with this normalization here, which is nothing but the power spectrum. So this 1 over K1 cubed part is the power spectrum zeta for K1. 1 over K3 cubed is the power spectrum zeta for K3. And this coefficient is exactly 1 minus ns. Okay. So before Maldacena did this calculation, we knew that this coefficient was of order slower parameter. But Maldacena showed that it's actually exactly 1 minus ns, which is a nice thing to know. And there's a deep reason why that's the case, and that's very important for testing single field inflation. All right, now, this result, which was obtained from single field canonical Bunch Davis vacuum slow-roll inflation by Maldacena. And he had an argument as to why this should apply to all single field models. And later, it was indeed extended to the generic single field models by these authors. And now we think that this relation holds for all single field models. So if you detect three-point function in this particular configuration, which you can do with data, I've done it before, and find that the coefficient of this bispectrum is greater than 1 minus ns, which is a tiny number, you rule out all single-field inflation. That's a statement. Okay, so this is independent of ice curvature perturbation or anything. Very clean way of ruling out all the single field. Okay, now let me then define this particular quantity called FNL, which is a ratio of a bispectrum to the product of power spectra. Now you take squeeze limit, namely K3 goes to zero, then you can relate this definition of FNL. If this is a working definition, this is a parameter that's you know, conventionally used in literature for constraining non-Gaussianity. Let me relate this parameter to this prediction by taking the squeeze limit bispectrum. Then I find that FNL is 512 times 1 minus ns. Because ns is 0.96, FNL is predicted to be 0.017. So if you then detect FNL much greater than this value, you rule out single field. So let me then quote limits on FNL, current limits. We will obtain some limits on this. But let me first also introduce terminology here. By defining FNL in this way, it's not guaranteed that this FNL is independent of K. It's not guaranteed. But let me assume that it is, in fact, independent of K. Then this particular choice of FNL is called local type, just to set the terminology straight. FNL can certainly depend on K. Then if you make that assumption, then for local form, FNL has been constrained to be 30 plus minus 20. One sigma. And Planck, that's the next generation CME satellite after WMAP, has taken data. In fact, one of the sensitive channels has already ended mission. First results are expected to come out next year. And they are expected to reach one sigma error bar of 5. If FNL is indeed 30, which doesn't need to be the case, Planck will see the 6 sigma. So by, say, early 2013, single field models will be gone. Okay? But if this turns out to be, say, 10 plus minus 5, well, that will keep the field going with 2 sigma. If it's 5 plus minus 5, maybe we need to find something else to do. And also, you can also try to constrain this quantity using not only WMAP, CNB, but also large scale structure that I'm going to talk about also during this talk. Then you can even obtain a more stringent limit. But no detection so far. We just hope that, okay, so even if Planck didn't see it, it is expected that the future large scale structure surveys are expected to reach delta FNL of 1. So there's a lot of excitement in this because the implication is huge. You rule out single field. However, before we go on there, right, because it's such a profound statement, we want to make sure that this is actually a correct statement. And there are two subtleties here, which I will talk about. So one is the condition by which this needs to be satisfied. The second is the subtlety regarding the initial state of quantum fluctuations. So let me quickly go through this theorem, which is a classical theorem developed by Maldacena and then followed up by Kreminieri and Zadariaga. So a nice way of thinking about this squeeze limit bispectrum is that because you have K3, which is very small compared to the other two momenta, you're basically correlating very long wavelength mode with the very short wavelength mode. So you have the essentially long wave perturbation on top of which you have short wavelength perturbation. Now, if there's no correlation between the two, which is normally the case for Gaussian fluctuations, then correlation should vanish. The amplitude of this should never care about the amplitude of this underlying fluctuation. If there's non-Gaussian, especially this squeeze limit type, then depending on the sign, you get larger fluctuation when you are sitting on top of the larger zeta or smaller fluctuation when it's sitting on top of the smaller data. So we can then nicely decompose this three-point function into two parts. One is long wavelength data and short wavelength data. And because squeeze limit by spectrum has one long and two shorts, you basically have correlation between zeta or long wavelength correlated with the power of short wave perturbation. So you have the variance, basically the power spectrum here of short wave. Let's see. Yeah, you have zeta short square. That's the power modulated by the long wavelength perturbation here. So then why should power ever care about underlying zeta? Which is not very easy to think why that should be the case. And why does it have anything to do with single field inflation, yes?
If you just consider the structure formation.
Yes?
So for the short wavelength, couples to the large wavelength, when you are in the overdense region. So the impact of the background of the short wavelength is a positive curvature universe, look up positive. So that will change the growth of the growth factor of this structure. How do you distinguish this factor from the non-Gaussian?
Yeah. So that's an excellent question. So even if you forget about all this primordial non-Gaussianity, there will be still this okay. So large scale structure is a separate question, which I'll do this later. But the answer to your question, large scale structure does a funny thing. So first of all, you have this amplitude of short wavelength perturbation, but then you do so-called thresholding and say you have a density. So let's say this is density above which threshold is above which you sample these peaks. And you call them galaxies. If you do this thresholding, you introduce non-Gaussianity already. So in that way, thresholding distorts the original probability distribution function. How do you distinguish this effect and the underlying effect? It turns out that the usual thresholding for Gaussian theory predicts that the so-called halo bias, the bias of galaxies, which is independent of K, as long as you're in a linear regime. For this particular type of non-Gaussian that I'm talking about, will give you 1 over k squared behavior. So the wave number dependence is very different. I'll come back to that point later. But this is important to actually remember that when you talk about galaxy large-scale structure, in fact, you are doing this thresholding, which will distort the probability distribution function. All right. So. And I'm going to tell you something that you are probably going to be very confused, but I will try to clarify it later. Now you have zeta KL, which left the horizon very early. Then you have these two patches of the universe, separated by more than Hubble. So these don't talk to each other. Within each Hubble horizon, you have a zeta short. This is, zeta short. Now, if you look at the metric, it looks like existence of long wavelength zeta either rescales x or a scale factor. In other words, depending upon how much zeta you have on the background side, smooth part, your patch expands by different amount, right? So what does that do to you? Well, so you are basically now talking about how the power spectrum of the short wavelength would respond to rescaling of either comoving coordinate or scale factor. If the power spectrum is scale invariant, namely, it actually doesn't matter how much you scale either comoving coordinate or scale factor, then of course correlation vanishes. So if NS is exactly one, there'll be no correlation between long and short. So put this into the context, you have a power spectrum correlation function of short wavelength separated by x minus y, which would be the correlation function in the absence of long wavelength perturbation, and then derivative of This is just a Taylor expansion. Derivative of that quantity with respect to the long wavelength zeta times long wavelength zeta. But as we just learned, derivative with respect to zeta is simply amounts of derivative with respect to log coordinate. Well, so derivative of correlation function with respect to log coordinate is nothing but 1 minus nf. You have, however, this extra p zeta l, well, that will modulate the amplitude of short wavelength perturbation here. Now, if you multiply this by zeta l itself, and take the exponential value, you get 1 minus ns. So that's what the Maldesen obtained using this more complicated informalism thing. But this is completely classical argument. And also, this relies on the fact that you can do this Taylor expansion and identification of zeta l with coordinate. Is that OK? You know, are we convincing enough to use this when we say we rule out single field inflation? So maybe it is more interesting to show this explicitly using, again, this quantum field theory computation. And maybe such a calculation will give us some idea about when this kind of argument is actually valid. And if we find some non-trivial counterexample, which turns out not to be counterexample, but nevertheless, we learned a lot from this, doing this. So now this is an interesting piece that my student came up with. The question is, how do you calculate two-point function in the presence of long wavelength perturbation? So naively, you do this. So you have zeta square, which simply then gives you zeta square and some kind of interaction Hamiltonian. But OK, if you do this naively, it vanishes. Because HI is cubic order. Of course, if you use H, the free Hamiltonian, you get just usual power spectrum. That's not interesting. If you do the interaction Hamiltonian, because this is zeta cubed and this is zeta square, you have five-point function which you vanish for Gaussian theory. But what happens is you do the long-short split, then each term, like zeta cubed, will be split into zeta short square, zeta L, or zeta L cubed, zeta short cubed, zeta S square, zeta L, zeta L square, zeta short. So you then have this quadratic piece in the Lagrangian for zeta short. And that's what you should be retaining. And then you have zeta short square coupled with zeta short square here, which is a four-point function, which will be non-zero. Gaussian theory. So this is a nice way of looking at things. And here's the result. So the when you have zeta short correlated in the presence of long wavelength zeta, you have indeed zeta long in front of some quantity here, which looks complicated. Now, the argument I just gave you tells you that this quantity here should become 1 minus ns, which I don't see at all, okay? So initially, that's not obvious at all. This is a piece that people have known before Maldacena's paper. This is a piece that Maldacena computed and turns out to be just half of this quantity which give you 1 minus ns. All right, although it's complicated, therefore, it's actually interesting, right? Because it's not obvious that you ever get 1 minus ns from here. So that was intriguing for us. But when we actually did computation for slow roll inflation or without any assuming, any slow roll, but look at a parallel inflation to all order and slow roll, we do recover 1 minus ns, which was like amazing. But there was this curious case. Felix Stravinsky wrote this paper claiming that there is a model of inflation which predicts exactly scale invariant spectrum. So motivation here is that people often said in the conferences that the inflation cannot predict ns equals 1. And he didn't like that. So for example, in the conference in Kyoto, which I attended, people said something like that. And he stood up and said, no, inflation can predict n is equal to 1. You know, he seemed very upset. And a few weeks later, this paper appeared. And indeed, you can do this. But if you look at the paper, it's really beautiful. It's very easy to understand what's going on. But why did I pick this particular model? Because according to the theorem I just presented, this model should give you zero by spectrum. Okay, so whatever I wrote here should go to zero. Does it really go to zero? That's a question. It didn't. It didn't go to zero. That was interesting. But now we understand why it didn't go to zero. It's minimally coupled to gravity. Minimally coupled, Bunch Davis, single field, vanilla. It's just potential is different.
It's exactly zero.
Exactly zero, yes. And it's by definition exactly zero. You'll see it in the next slide, why that's the case, yes?
But the calculation that you're describing, is it any different? I mean, is it like one convenient limit of the Mandelsen?
That's right, that's right. And Mandelsen has, of course, picked up one particular mode function, which we didn't. Therefore, the final result actually depends on these mode functions. And obtaining this, using the Mandelsen's way and taking the squeeze limit after, it's probably more complicated than what we just did here.
But it's not like a different
design. It's not any different. It's just a nice way of thinking about this consistency relation. Yeah. Okay. So I have this Meccano-Sasaki equation for the mode function of UK. And it really boils down to this. So this Z is A phi dot divided by H. And scary invariant spectrum demands that this particular quantity is 2 over eta squared. So you have a Hankel function of order 3 half. That's the origin of scary invariant spectrum, right? So what Stravinsky did was to just impose this by hand. So by definition, you have scary invariant spectrum. And then solve for potential, because this depends on potential. Yeah? Very clever. Then he got this potential. So inflation starts somewhere here, field rolls down, and inflation ends when phi is very large.
So is it basically that the slower brother, epsilon and beta are balancing to cancel each other to get a totally flat spectrum?
Yeah, but this is not swirl, so maybe cancellation happening to higher order in slower parameters also. This is exact, because by definition, So for example, if you expand this into slower parameters, you have quadratic terms and cubic terms, right? They should all cancel out. Now, inflation lasts very long when phi n is very large. So keep that in mind, because that turns out to be important later. Then we got this result. So zeta s, in the presence of long wavelength perturbation, is non-zero. And it was very puzzling through the first. But as you can see, so again, k1 is the large wave number. Eta start is essentially reciprocal of the horizon size at the beginning of inflation. And the phi end is the phi value at the end of inflation. Now, if inflation lasts very long, phi end goes to infinity. Then this goes to zero. So what does that mean? What that means is, if inflation lasts long, then the k long, k3, that we observe, will be really outside the horizon during inflation. Well, that's basically the condition for this theorem to work, because theorem assumes that you have zeta 3, which acts like a modulation of the classical background. So it has to be constant, and has to be constant, basically. So essentially, as K3 goes outside the horizon, this quantity approaches to zero exponentially. But it didn't. If you have K3, which is just outside the horizon or something like that, then this quantity doesn't vanish. So that's a limitation of theorem, which was built in the assumption of this Kriminarian Zardari's argument anyway. It's purely classical argument. So we sort of understand why we are getting this result. And also, nicely, this also shows you that, okay, when you have 1 minus n s exactly zero, you have next leading order correction to the squeeze limit by spectrum, which I presented, which goes at k squared. All right, now what have we learned so far? Okay, so can we rule out inflation using single field inflation using squeeze limit by spectrum? Answer seems to be yes. But we have to make sure that this K3 is really outside the horizon during inflation. But we haven't looked at this question of modified initial state. Everything I said so far actually relied on the fact that UK is Bunch Davis, because we couldn't do general calculation for general mode function here. If you have a general mode function here, I don't see how you can get 1 minus NS ever. So that question remains to be seen. But I think sort of people tend to agree that the exact squeeze limit, k if it goes to zero, should still obey the consistency relation, namely 1 minus NS. So now I think we're going into more practical question. Okay, we cannot actually measure K3 equals zero because that's not perturbation. We have to be talking about K3 over K1, which is small but finite. How finite is it? For example, if you look at CMB, we now measure things from L equals 2 to L of 3000. And dash the curve, the primordial CMB, solid curve is the best fit to the data, as you can see that the discrepancy, which means these modes are contaminated by foreground emission, which you need to remove. But we tend to think that we can do this subtraction properly up until L of 3000, beyond which we probably have no control. So let's imagine that we can measure modes from L to 2 to 3000. Then the longest perturbation, longest wavelength corresponds to L equals 2, shortest will correspond to L of 3000, therefore ratio is 1 part in 1500. That's the most squeezed configuration you ever get from CMB. That's small, but it's not too tiny, right? So that's why it's interesting to look at this question. What happens if K3 over K1 is small but finite? Large scale structure, so this is the power spectrum of matter. I think realistically, you cannot probably, so CMB can go to K of 10 to minus 4, and for those of you who are not familiar with the conversion between the two, L is K times 14,000 megaparsec. And L of 2 corresponds to 10 to minus 4 in K in this particular unit. So CME can go all up here, that's 10 to minus 4 here. Logical structure so far went down only to 10 to minus 2 inverse megaparsec. I think the future surveys will go to 10 to minus 3, but probably not beyond. That's just too hard to do. But also, large scale structure goes to the much higher K, K of about over order 1. CMB stops at K of about 0.3, not 1. As a result, large scale structure also is sensitive to K3 over K1, as small as 1 part in 1000. Small, but not too tiny. But then this new thing came out. The distortion of the thermal spectrum of cosmic microwave background. We all learn and teach in cosmology class that, okay, first thing you teach is actually CMB's black body. Well, it is, but may not have to be completely black body. And I will show you later that, in fact, using the distortion of CMB can tell you something about squeeze limit by spectrum, which was first pointed out by Enrico Pache and Matias Zarrillaga very recently. And this K3 over K1 can be as small as anyone said. Now, of course, this is not trivial why that's the case, and I'll tell you why. So this is potentially a very exciting avenue to look at the squeeze by spectrum, but the bottom line message here is that as long as you stick to conventional probes like large scale structure or CMB, it's essentially 10 to minus 3 is what you get for K3 over K1. Okay, now back to informalism. So you have this formalism, and that will give you the bias spectrum that looks like this. Okay? You have more functions. Now, if you have a bunch of Davis vacuum, so U prime is the U with respect to differentiated with respect to conformal time. Boundary Davis vacuum gives you that this UK prime is eta times eta minus ik eta. So eta cubed cancels out 1 over eta cubed here. And what you are simply left with is the eta e to the minus I k1 plus k2 plus k3 eta, which you can, of course, trivially integrate. This will give you 1 over k1 plus k2 plus k3 with an annoying factor that you actually have e to the minus I sum over k eta today, or eta 0, minus e to the minus I sum over k infinity, which you have to do something about. And usually people go to the complex plane a little bit. And because sum of the momenta is positive always, you can kill this contribution. And if you read, for example, Peskin and Schrader, you learn that that's equivalent to choosing the interacting vacuum. Basically, that's a choice that will leave the ground state of interacting vacuum. Namely, you kill all the excited states by going to the complex plane a little bit. That's what the people normally do. So eta 0, in this case, will be taken to negative infinity plus I epsilon. That's fine. And if you take the squeeze limit, k3 goes to 0. And k1 is equal to k2, so you have 1 over 2k1. Now you go to non-bunch Davis vacuum. Then you have this positive, negative frequency mode. Then you start having terms like this, which will give you a term like that. So if k3 goes to 0, k1 is equal to k2. Therefore, you get 1 minus k3 instead of 1 minus 1 over, you get 1 over k3 instead of 1 over k1. And because k3 is much less than k1, you get enhancement with respect to the usual term by k1 minus k3, which can be 10 to the 8 for this thermal distortion of the CMB, or at least 1,000 for large scale structure in CMB. That's large. So what does that mean for example, consistency relation? So if you go, yes?
When you consider non-bunch Davis vacuum, you also have to check that the resulting vacuum state is Hadamard. I mean, that just means that if you look at correlators at short distances, that will reduce to the flat space.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, thank you very much. So what we're really doing the following. We have the new vacuum state here, which is given by proportional to just correcting the important terms, 2k cubed, and then alpha k, and then 1 plus ik eta, e to the minus ik eta, plus beta k, which is negative frequency mode. Of course, it's simply usual Bogoliubov transformation. And then what we, of course, have to assume is that when k goes to infinity, you should recover usual Minkowski vacuum. Therefore, beta k has to go to 0. And we achieve this by simply saying that the beta k, and we don't really have to assume anything, but we can, if you will, assume that the beta k is actually e to the minus k square divided by k cut square something. But as long as this goes to 0 as you go to k infinity, you're fine. So, okay, so this is important, and thanks for bringing that up. We're modifying IR behavior of mode function, but not UV part. UV part is completely fixed by the fact that the space-time looks like Minkowski on small scale. All right, now, if you do the computation, then you get this usual 1 minus NS piece, and this funny K1 over K3 piece, times 1 minus cosine, K3 times this initial A0. Now, if you then say, okay, I fix k3. In fact, okay, I fix eta 0 and take k3 to be arbitrarily small. This vanishes. Therefore, you recover our usual Maldacena piece. So this exact squeeze limit behavior is still restored. But if I did that, you know, k3 is much less than 1 over eta 0 at the beginning, we don't really know what we're doing. Because you say that when the initial conditions are laid out, you already have super horizon fluctuations. No, we don't really know what that means. So let me then investigate the case where K3 times eta 0 is over the unity. Then squeeze limit biasman receive this enhancement of K1 over K3 times a slower parameter, which is epsilon. Epsilon minus 2. And I told you that this quantity can be at least 10 to the 3. So you get all the unity correction to the usual effect. And the bispectrum grows faster than local form. So if you go to the K3 small, usual bispectrum goes like 1 over K3 cubed, but this particular non-bounded vacuum construction shown there, it's 1 over K to the 4. That will have interesting consequences for bias and distortion of CMB. Yeah.
I think that you change the initial condition, the spectral, the power spectrum.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Also, it becomes tailed by five.
Yes, thank you. So then, what you have is P of zeta of k is proportional to, usually it's just alpha k squared, but now you have alpha k plus beta k squared. And you just have to make sure that this doesn't depend on k very much. This should be more or less 1 over k cubed, or k to the 4 minus ns, and ns is, roughly speaking, 1. You can achieve that by basically saying that, okay, beta k is constant as long as k is much less than your cutoff scale. Right. So that's an observation requirement.
Oh, so basically, it's determined by that ratio,
like
the k over the k
cut. Amplitude of it is, yes. The amplitude of beta k will depend on k cut. But the shape is essentially arbitrary. Right? You can just multiply any function here. But then the scale invariance observation constrains that to be slowly varying with respect to k. So OK, so that's another important point. So what do we do here? We are not really a priori constructing a model of non-bunched Davis vacuum because I don't know how to do it. I have some ideas, but I don't know how to do it just yet explicitly. But as an observational cosmologist, I can just talk to data, right? Data, tell me what's going on. Because you know UV behavior is fixed by Minkowski vacuum, but IR part isn't. It's basically free. Then you ask data to tell us what the IR behavior is, and that's all we're doing here. And this particular modification IR behavior influences all kinds of IR observables. Very IR observable is galaxy power spectrum. So you have a galaxy power spectrum divided by the matter power spectrum, which will be different because of the thresholding I told you about. Because of thresholding, these two quantities are not equal. In fact, because of this modulation of density with respect to zeta, you get something very peculiar. Okay, so for example, let me just first tell you that there's a relation between, oh, it's square here. So a Poisson equation, which basically tells you that the Laplacian potential is proportional to density, is this. So you have density perturbation, k squared, not cubed, times zeta. So that will relate delta to zeta. And because bispectrum tells you how zeta modulates with respect to zeta L, now you can translate that into how delta modulates as a function of zeta. The important point here is that when zeta is positive, delta is positive also. Okay, so you have more zeta, you have more density fluctuations. And because of this k square here, you end up having the peculiar behavior of this bias as a function of k. But let me just say that, okay, I said it already, but let me repeat it because it's important. The existence of long wavelength perturbation zeta changes the small scale power of delta through this the delta zeta relationship, Poisson equation. Positive long wavelength zeta means more power on small scales, just like I showed there. More power on small scales means more galaxies because more power means more peaks will go above thresholds, right? Then you get this scale dependent bias. This is a bias, and then you have, okay, it's complicated, but I just wanted to emphasize that this MR here is essentially the coefficient in the relation between zeta and density, and I told you that it's k square. You see here that it's 1 over k square, okay? And f of r here is not very important quantity, but for local bias, f of r is constant. And for non-bounded vacuum case, this f of r goes like 1 over k. And in general, for a bias spectrum that goes like 1 over k to the p power, this scale-dependent bias goes like 1 over k to the p minus 1. Now, where does this formula come from? It comes from simply calculating the correlation of peaks. That's it. And this was worked out by various people, people like Mike Wise or Sabino Materese in 1980s. It comes from statistics. So for local form, for which p is 3, it goes like 1 over k squared. It's a very distinct scaling with respect to k. For non-bounded vacuum, since it's p equals 4, we would expect it to go like 1 over k cubed. So we've done integral, and it does. So this is the, once again, ratio of the galaxy power spectrum to the matter power spectrum. For Gaussian theory, it's all to the constant. And since I've subtracted 1 from the, subtracted the usual bias piece, it goes to go to 0 in this diagram. So if it's Gaussian theory, it's 0 in this diagram. For local form of FNL of 10, let's say, the galaxy power spectrum increases as 1 over k squared as you go to lower k, lower wave number. But non-bounded vacuum does this crazy thing, it's 1 over k cubed. If that's true, it has a very important consequence for observations. Once again, this is a toy model. We just adapted this at some finite conformal time, which may or may not be correct way of doing things. But if it is, then that's a consequence. You can also calculate CMB by spectrum. Now, and then this is a little subtle, but let me tell you what we actually do when we measure FNL from the data. We have CMB data from which we compute the bias spectrum. Then we fit local form template to the observed bias spectrum and extract FNL. In other words, we are not proving that the data have local form bias spectrum. We're just assuming the data would have a local form bias spectrum. Therefore, if I fit local form template to the data, we would extract best fitting FNL. Regardless of whether local form is a good fit to the data, we're not questioning that. No matter what the non-Gaussian in the data we have, we're just fitting it to local form. But non-bounded vacuum bias spectrum is clearly not local form. But I can do the same thing. I can then fit local form template to this data that we created, non-bounded vacuum, and figure out what would be the FNL we would find if we didn't know that what we have is non-bounded vacuum, not local form. The answer is 8. Planck's 1 sigma, okay, 8 for fairly, eight for the order unity beta. Okay. So that's sort of maximum you can get. If that's the case, then Planck will see it. So that's already telling you something important, right? So okay, we all learned that detection of FNL will rule out all single field inflation models. But we should be careful about effective initial state, actually. But we're not completely doomed. In fact, what this non-bounded vacuum does is to create bias spectrum in various configurations. So basically, it produces non-Gaussianity when you have K2, K3, and K1. This collinear configuration is what generated. This includes squeeze limit. That's the reason why we are getting this enhancement in squeeze limit. But local form doesn't produce this. So So if Planck detects local form, the next thing we should do is to look at this configuration and see if we have a similar enhancement there. If we do see it, it's non-bunches vacuum. If we don't, that's local form. Okay. So that's how we distinguish between the two. Then, of course, we can look at the scale-dependent bias spectrum, and that will be very telltelling. Now let's go to the mu distortion. I'll be very brief on this. Okay, so now, how does it work? All right, so where does this acoustical signal come from? It's basically coming from these waves. You know, we have photon binding plasma, inflation drop the stone, namely initial perturbation, creates ripples. You see this acoustic oscillations. But if you see the data, oscillation is actually damping. And that's because this picture is correct only when photons and baryons are completely tightly coupled. But look at the microscopic scales, photons are free streaming. So the scale is less than free streaming length of the photon. These waves are damped. That's why you see this damping tail. We see in the data. Must be true. Now you are damping these acoustic waves. Where does the energy go? It has to go somewhere. It actually heats CMB photons, creates entropy. That will lead to distortion of the thermal spectrum. So suppose that you inject some energy. I'm not specifying what injecting energy. You inject energy delta E. It's injected into cosmic plasma during radiation error. What happens? CMB spectrum should be distorted because you just added energy, right? But it thermalizes, actually. So if redshift is greater than 10 to the 6, by the way, Big Bang nucleosynthesis is 10 to the 9, so it's well after Big Bang nucleosynthesis. This double Compton scattering changes the number of photons. So because of that, even if you added like delta function energy, it relaxes to Planck distribution. But after this epoch, this photon non-conserving reaction decouples. But you still have this photon conserving elastic scattering until redshift about 10 to the 4. Then distribution still relaxes to equilibrium distribution, but it's not going to be Planckian distribution because you're conserving the number of photons. Instead, you go to the Fermi-Dirac distribution, I'm sorry, Bose-Einstein distribution with the finite chemical potential. Then you can work out what this mu actually is going to be by simple argument. So you go from this Planckian to Bose-Einstein. Now you have the photon energy density that's given by nu cubed d nu integrated. That will give you t to the 4 energy density. OK, now you're adding energy, delta E, divided by some commuting volume here. That's going to lead to different distribution with chemical potential in it. You then, mu is small anyway, so theta expand to the first order mu. That's your energy conservation. But number of density doesn't change. It's elastic scattering. So you just say, okay, I equate nu squared d nu integrated, nu squared d nu integrated, and that's what I get. Okay, now you can solve for mu as a function of delta E. That's the answer. So if you inject energy with respect to cosmic plasma, let's say you inject 10% of energy to it, then you get basically 10% mu back, 0.1. Right. All right, that's cool. So how much energy does this CMB plasma has, this cosmic plasma has? It's basically sound speed times energy density photon times perturbation photon square. It takes yens to calculate these factors. So he found very interesting thing. So this is the energy that's stored in the cosmic plasma. But he showed that only 1/3 of it goes into heating CMB, creating entropy. 2/3 just goes to radiating temperature of CMB without distorting CMB possibly. That's great. That's great to know. That's your heat. You then basically add it up as a function of time. And because CMB, so mu distortion is created only during this range in the redshift, you do this integration only within that redshift, you're basically sensitive to, okay, important, perturbation square on small scale. Right? Just like this. Now you are modulating photon perturbation square on small scale in the presence of long wavelength zeta. It's exactly the same story as a scale-dependent bias. But bottom line here is that this process of damping acoustic wave and heating CMB is happening at the a mean free path of CMB, which is tiny, at this such early epoch. It turns out that, for example, redshift of medium, k of 10 to the 4, and redshift of 10,000 is 50 megaparsec inverse. That's really large. And then, therefore, this is used to, this can be potentially used to probe very, very squeezed bispectrum that we wouldn't be able to have an access to before. So the same story, the existence of long wavelength zeta changes delta gamma square. Positive long wavelength zeta, more power on small scales. More power on small scales, more mu distortion. And this is a new phenomenology. Imagine that you have a full sky CMB. At each pixel, you measure thermal spectrum of CMB. You calculate mu distortion at each pixel. And that's inhomogeneous. It's anisotropic. You can even create a map of mu. But mu is isotropic if you don't have this squeeze limit bispectrum. Mu is anisotropic only when you have something like this. So that's a new phenomenon, new observable one can look for. Then we can have this mu temperature cross correlation, because you have map of mu, you can then directly cross correlate that with the temperature map of WMAP. Temperature is zeta itself. Zeta L is what you see in the Sachs-Wolfe effect. In small scale, you have delta gamma, which is basically zeta S squared. So correlating these or for the bispectrum in the squeeze configuration with this tiny K3 to K1. So more precisely, if you go, now I have a map of mu, which I decompose into spherical harmonics. I have a map of temperature, which I decompose into spherical harmonics. And this is the usual thing of temperature. And this is a new piece for mu. Indeed, that's dependent on zeta square. Correlate the two, you get bispectrum in squeeze limit. So then here, the integral is dominated by K1 equals K2 equals KD, which is big, can be as big as 10,000 inverse megaparsec. But this small k is a CMB scale. And that's essentially L divided by RL, where RL is 14,000 megaparsec. That's tiny. The ratio of the two will give you 10 to the minus 8, 10 to the minus 6. This is the, let's forget about non-Bunsen's vacuum. I'm almost done now. Let's forget about non-Bunsen's vacuum. Let's look at a local form result, so FNL. Then you have this L square times correlation power spectrum. That's basically flat, just like Sachs-Wolfe. So it's scale invariant spectrum in some sense. Okay, that's assuming Sachs-Wolfe effect. If we include all the radiation transfer effects, that's what you get. It would be really cool to measure this thing. Unfortunately, the effect is tiny. Unless FNL is much greater than 1,000, you're not going to see this in the foreseeable future. But if you have then non-Bunsen's vacuum, you have this K1 over K3 enhancement, which is a factor of million to 100 million, then we are in a different regime. If this beta coefficient here is order unity, which doesn't need to be, by the way, but if it is, expected signal to noise from the future experiment, immediate future experiment, is 60. We're going to see this, totally see this, right? If we don't, then we're constraining occupation number of initial quantum. Yeah? So that's new observable. Now future work. Okay, this is, you know, I'm fascinated by this, but there's one thing that I'm bothered by, namely, we don't really know anything about beta. I mean, okay, I'll be asking nature data to tell me what the beta is. But is this formulation correct in the first place? So it would be really nice to have a consistent construction of inflationary theory that doesn't require you to cut off things at the finite conformal time, but that will take initial perturbation in an infinity past. Something happens at eta zero, but you have a smooth transition and make predict observables. So that's what we're working on right now. But at the phenomenological level, I found it very interesting. Okay, summary. So we started asking this question, can we rule out single field inflation by looking at squeeze limit bispectrum? The answer seems to be yes, but that requires you to be in very squeezed limit. You know, K3 is essentially zero. If K3 over K1 is small but finite, then you start looking at some exotic effects like non-Bunge's vacuum effect, which, you know, needs to be looked at. You can create CMB bispectrum, you can create scale-dependent bias, and it makes even mu-type distortion anisotropic. And all of these can be detectable by future experiments. So, squeeze limit bias offers testable signal inflation, also initial state of quantum fluctuations. And these are two new things that I wanted to point out, and stop here. Thank you.